Welcome to the Camp 4 Performance Podcast. This is the official podcast of Camp 4 Human Performance, a company started by Dr. Tyler Nelson to give you the most up-to-date, practical, and usable information on rock climbing performance, training, and rehabilitation. In this episode, we are proud to introduce our newest Camp 4 coach, Coach Jesse Firestone. And if you've been in the loop with some rock climbing podcasts recently, I believe on The Nugget, Jesse has been already producing some amazing quality and information for the climbing community with his wisdom on skills coaching to philosophy, mindset, and really everything in between. Listening to Coach Jesse and Coach Gabe go back and forth about skills, mindset, tactics, approach, philosophy, it was truly an awesome thing to be a part of. So this is one of my probably favorite episodes thus far. Before we get into this, I wanted to give a quick shout out to one of our sponsors, Fizzy Vantage. Fizzy Vantage is the sports nutrition company giving you the physical advantage to reach your fitness goals and rock climbing goals, whatever they may be. Right now, I'm rocking the new product, which is the Fizzy Vantage Greens. And if you're like me, an athlete and a coach, greens are not always the most fun thing to put on your plates. I come from a nutrition degree background from Cornell University, and trust me, I still don't like to do it. So when it comes to the days where I'm not feeling so psyched on greens, or I have a busy day coaching, it's nice to know that I can throw a scoop into water, and the mild mint flavor is actually really tasteful, and it's really good. There's no texture, there's no chalkiness, it goes down really smooth. You know, I'm going to try and get in my Whole Foods as well, but it's nice knowing to have I have a quality product at my side that's ready to go and that tastes great as well. Also rocking the plant-based cold brew at my gym as well for some post-workout protein that, again, goes really well with water. And that's usually one of my biggest things when it comes to protein shakes and whatnot. Milk is great, you know, makes it taste better, but more practically is when things taste well with water and, you know, both of those hit the nail on the head. So make sure if you are looking to supplement your nutrition to improve your rock climbing, your fitness goals with high quality products that also taste good, go check Fizzy Vantage out at fizzyvantage.com. And you have to plug C4HP20 at the end of that shopping cart, and it's going to give you 20% off. So go over and see the awesome products and people at Fizzy Vantage. Also, shout out Fizzy Vantage for being a Pennsylvania rooted company, just like yours truly from Reading, Pennsylvania. One last announcement to make before we head into this podcast is that we have some new courses going on at Camp 4. Dr. Tyler Nelson has some new live and in-person strength and conditioning courses that he's going to be booking and flying around the country to do. So make sure you head over to the website to check out the dates and registrations for that. And we are announcing our brand new Camp 4 Performance Certified Coaches certification. And this is going to bridge the gap between the fitness professional and the skills coach. We're really looking to help the youth competitive team coaches environment and help better physically prepare our athletes to handle the demands of their sport, but also grow and develop into the athletes that they're meant to reach their full potential, to have long and healthy careers. The certification aims to educate all the coaches on how to better manage and understand strength, power, and endurance, both on and off the wall. Not only will coaches learn how to better organize training for their teams and understand when to schedule strength, when to schedule power, how to integrate it into a skills lesson, but also better understand how to actually physically coach these exercises, how to coach them, cue them, demonstrate them well, think critically on their feet, because each coach is going to have to read through text and content online and pass a pretest before showing up to the in-person part of the course. And at the end of the course, each coach is going to have to pass an in-person practical, demonstrating their proficiency in not only knowing what exercises are, but how to coach them, how to demonstrate them effectively, and how to think critically on their feet. Sure, we're going to understand how to demonstrate a squat well, or a lunge well, or a push-up well. But what if an athlete comes in with a sore elbow? How do we progress that? How do we regress that? How do we think critically on our feet? How do we set up assessments properly, that we would get the best information out of our athletes. So as a coach, you're going to leave this course feeling confident, not only in better understanding strength, power, endurance, and how it applies to rock climbing, but how to program it. How does it fit into your schedule, into your calendar year, into your competition year? And how are you going to physically coach this and become a better in-person communicator, coacher, cueer, and demonstrator? That way, all this information that you'll be learning will be communicated effectively to those that you work with in large groups. And if you're a one-on-one personal training coach or you have online clients, this information applies to you too. Our first two courses are going to be live very soon. We will be out in Gilbert, Arizona at Alta Climbing Gym, June 24th and 25th. And we will be in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania at Ascend Climbing Gym, August 12th and 13th. The registrations for those courses will be live soon, so please stay tuned to our social medias, newsletters, and our website. We'll be announcing that as they go live very shortly. Alrighty, that's enough announcements for today. Let's dive into this podcast. We got Dr. Tyler Nelson, myself, Coach Colin McGee, Coach Gabe Olson, and our newest Camp 4 coach, Coach Jay Fire, Jesse Firestone. So today we're just going to introduce our new coach, Coach Jesse, aka Coach Jay Fire, and get him officially acquainted via the podcast, though he's already doing some amazing things both on social media and for Camp 4 as well. So you have probably seen him on our accounts, but if not, we're going to welcome Jesse today and give him the stage. So Jesse, if no one, you know, as I always say, if they're living under rocks and not climbing them, who are you and what's going on?
Yeah, all right. Cool. Good to be here. Thanks for the intro. I'm Jesse Firestone. I hope you guys can't hear my dog licking himself like 3 feet away. I hope that's my mic's not picking that up.
So licking his
he's licking his paws. It seems really loud to me because I'm in the room, but I've been a rock climber for like 17 years. And I've been really focused on climbing and training and pushing it as hard as I can for like 14 of those years. Basically, I was in college for computer science, and then I sort of got the climbing bug, and I like dropped out and moved into my Dodge Neon and like got real serious about rock climbing and did the dirt bag thing for quite a while. And then I went back to computer science. So I'm kind of classically educated in computer science, did that for a long time, but I've always been like super interested in both strength and conditioning, and then also especially like athlete psychology and sports science, because that's kind of the area of climbing that I probably excel in the most, is like mindset. So that's like a big area of interest for me is psychology, and that's what I tend to help my clients with. But I'm also an all-arounder. Like I'm interested in strength and conditioning, and I'm interested in climbing technique, obviously. So that's probably the brief rundown. But yeah, good to be here. I'm excited because I rarely get to bounce ideas off of so many like knowledgeable people. So
do you still own the Dodge Neon?
No, God, no, no, I upgraded it to like a Chevy Astro panel van, and I had that for a number of years. And actually now me and Colin are in the same club. I have a Tacoma.
Oh, let's go.
Northwest. Life.
I just looked it up. I just looked it up on the internet. You can go 0-60 in a Dodge Neon in 9.9 seconds.
Ooh.
I
drove a Saturn that I'm pretty sure had a 50cc engine in it. It was terrible.
I don't think Tacomas can hit 60 degrees or miles an hour.
Yeah, can't definitely do 60. 60 degrees, you know, they're rolling at that point.
That's what I realized, because I came from a Subaru WRX, so I was going zoom zoom with a turbo, and now I avoid merging at all costs because I can't. I don't know how to, and luckily it's all terrain. I can just go off the road if I need to. But that's awesome. Welcome to the taco party. That's great. So I think Alex has one too, right? I always see Alex. Yeah, hers is sick.
Yeah, she's got a nice one.
Awesome.
Cool. So, I'd say talk a little bit more about what got you so focused on perhaps the psychology aspect of things. In sports in general, I think one of the underutilized, in most cases, aspect of getting better is really investing as much time into understanding sports psychology as we do sets and reps of the physical stuff. Because I know for me personally, my best turnaround moment in high school baseball, and something I wish I carried on into college baseball, was the intent behind the mindset and visualization and all the lessons I learned. I picked up a book by, I think he passed away now, but Ken Revisa, who was a sports psychologist for a few of some Hall of Famers and major leaguers. And that book really gave me some tangible things as far as active thought process, rather than like just clear your mind and whatever, like, no, throw something active and positive in your mind so that you can take up space positively rather than leave room for any negative thoughts and so on and so forth. Long story short, I had my best baseball year ever. And I thought it was just going to carry over and stick around. And it really didn't. I think looking back, and I tell all my high school athletes and stuff that I work with, like, if you can get into sports psychology in some capacity, do so, but don't let it go. Give it as much time as you do coming in here to see me lifting weights and practicing the physical side too.
Yeah, at least as much time. I mean, the cool thing about working on your mindset is your brain gets tired, but it doesn't get tired the same way your muscles do. Like, you can visualize your sequence for your project like a lot of times in a day, and you don't really get diminishing returns from that the way that you do from like doing reps of some exercise, right? So you kind of started that with asking me how I got so interested in it. And I think a lot of people probably have this story, but like when I got into climbing, I was a total nerd. I had always been a computer guy. I was like way under my BMI for my height. Every time I'd see my doctor, he was like, dude, you need to like eat some junk food or something, like gain some weight because you're dangerously underweight. So I'm 5'10". I weighed like 120 pounds when I started climbing. And, you know, five or six years into climbing, I had put muscle on, but I was still just a scrawny guy compared to like everybody I climbed with. But a lot of those people, I could do as well as them. And some people who, you know, looked more the part of an athlete, I could consistently outperform. And that became especially true when I started climbing outside more and more, because I just got out a lot. I think the main thing is I got outside more than other people did, right? But some of these guys who were way stronger than me would come out from the gym and I would be able to like climb circles around them on these problems. And I just became very interested in like why that was the case, right? And I think like visualization, like you mentioned, is probably an enormous piece of that. And also just your like comfort with the environment and familiarity and stuff, like spending a lot of time in that context trying to perform is super important. I guess the short answer is I just was very interested in that gulf between like, why do these people who seem so much stronger than me seem to have a hard time performing on things that I can perform on, when I like, you know, at that point I had really never done any finger training. I'd like heard of max hangs, but to me it just seemed like a really heinous like thing to put myself through. It's like, why would I do that when I could just like get in my car and drive to the crag and go climbing, which is like way more pleasant to experience, right? So that was very fascinating to me. And it led me down this like whole road of like, what does performance come from? Which is something I'm still super interested in.
Gotcha. Looks like you're ahead of your time on the max hangs thing. Look at that.
I don't know. I harp on finger training a lot, and I have done my time with max hangs, but I feel like they're one of those things where you do it at some point and you get your gains from it. And then as long as you keep climbing, those gains don't really go away in a serious way. So it's a useful thing for people to maybe experience one time in their climbing career, but it's probably not like a training modality that needs to stick around for decades,
right,
per person.
Yeah. I think Tyler and I kind of accidentally at the same time posted something similar where we didn't really do a bunch of loaded heavy whatevers. And we just kind of hopped on something and we were curious. And I think Tyler did the first like 10 millimeter hold that you did hanging. And I was able to do like a classic Allison Fest between the legs pull up, and I got like 190 to come off the ground, and I made, I think, 205 wiggle, but I counted it. And I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like, my passive tension and all that max hang stuff is sticking around, but I didn't really have to put my body through the stress and the cost of it to see those gains. And that's a cool little fun little event. But again, it speaks to that. Like, you don't have to thrash your body to receive those benefits or really keep them. Which is nice. So, and it's a liberating moment too.
Like, years before the whole passive tension thing, I think I didn't understand the mechanism, but I kind of stumbled on that myself because I was working with a coach at the beginning of the pandemic, And this coach was like, we're going to test your max hang, and then we're going to do some max hangs, and then we're going to test your max hang. And I kind of realized after a few cycles of that, that when it was time to test it and I was going to really give it 100% effort, I could just keep adding weight to the max hang. Like if I wasn't trying to hold the half crimp and I could let my hands go into drag, I could add more weight to that than my shoulders could tolerate. My shoulders were failing before my fingers were. And it was at the point where like squatting the weight off the ground was challenging for me, you know? And I was like, well, this doesn't really seem like I'm actually training my fingers, you know? And I basically told my coach, like, I don't want to either want to train some other grip or a smaller hold where I add less weight, or I want to like somehow move away from this because I just don't have enough weights in my garage for this to be helping. And it seems like it's mostly hitting my shoulders and not actually hitting my fingers. And my coach at the time couldn't explain it. But then, you know, like 4 or 5 years later or whatever, 3 years later, Tyler started posting all this passive tension stuff, and it kind of like clicked in my head. I was like, oh, like my fingers were not, they really weren't being significantly trained by that exercise. They were just sort of like hanging on for the ride, it seemed like.
Hmm. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yep. Thank you, Dr. Nelson. And it was always cool looking back at the, I think Tyler's posting too, because you had a throwback back when Instagram posts were horizontal videos and you were like testing your fingers in isolation and just kind of like, oh my God, it was there the whole time. And, you know, but hey, that's what it is.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't see it either. Something that's interesting that I wanted to say with Jesse's comment is there like the coordination adaptation hasn't really been that studied in sports science, but we kind of lend a lot of the ideas from like the pain world and from the pain literature. And there's quite a bit of like coordination and like the developmental side of like the research. And essentially what the pain literature shows is for people that like have trouble getting up and walking across the room, like an elderly person, because they have pain complaints or they don't have strength to do it. When they do a functional MRI on their brain, if they get up and walk across the room and they measure it, the exact same cellular network happens when they sit in the chair and visualize it. And like the timing is the same, which is like so cool that it like literally is, you know, if you visualize yourself doing something like that is probably one of the most important things you can do for sports performance, you know. And some of the research on baseball, and Colin, this will hit home with you, is, oh, that's a good pun.
I was just going to say, pun. Yeah, that was a good pun.
It'll slide into home.
But essentially what it says is like, there's no way your reaction time is fast enough to hit over 100 mile an hour fastball. So essentially what happened before based on your expectation of what kind of pitch the pitcher threw, and the visualization that you've done before and all the millions of practice swings you've done, which is so trippy. It's so cool to think about that way.
It is crazy. Tyler, objectively, there's no way.
I don't know if this is from the anatomy class that we did, but I remember hearing about this study at some point that really stuck with me, where it might be from a book I read at some point, but they had people train their grip strength. And then they had like a control group where they just like, you know, didn't do anything special. And then they had people who, you know, trained it with like a set and rep scheme where they were working their grip strength every day. Then they had people who just visualized squeezing a thing as hard as they could, and they didn't do any actual training. And then they had a group that did the actual training and the visualization. And like the group that did the training and visualization, they got the biggest gains. The group that did the training got like pretty good gains. The group that only did the visualization still got gains.
Yeah.
That like blows my mind, but it totally makes sense with that whole idea I have, where you can like visualize your project as much as you want to, right? And it counts as training. It's like, it works.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it depends if like, I don't remember which citation you're showing, but if it was an athlete and you took an athlete away from doing their normal grip training for 3 or 4 weeks and have them visualize that, you're deconditioning them a little bit too. So they're force output will be higher because now they're becoming more anaerobic and they'll just be able to squeeze down. A little deconditioning will go a long ways for force production too. Mm-hmm. To make it more confusing for everyone listening.
This podcast went, whoa, sideways.
But I really am still trying to figure out how Jesse lived in a 13.1 feet cubed cargo volume. I looked that up too.
Got the blueprint.
No, I think I told this story on the Nugget, but like, right after I dropped out of college, I rolled up in Yosemite in my Dodge Neon and like pulled my Walmart tent out of the trunk and like set my Walmart tent up in Camp 4. And immediately some other people came over and they were just like, dude, what is up with your tent?
Dude, you're like a fucking boss.
Walmart family tent. Yeah, that's what it took.
That's legit. I love that story.
That's funny. That is amazing. Gabe, did you have something you're about to say?
No, I think we segued. I had it and now it's gone. It'll come back.
That's right. Yeah, we're going in circles anyway. Yeah. If I had, this was Jason. I guess the baseball thing is so true because, yeah, there's no way. It's like back before that, this age when everyone throws over 100 miles an hour, the reference point was always like 90 miles an hour. And at that point, it was 0.04 seconds to see it, recognize, make active decision, put round object on round ball, and hopefully it doesn't cause an out. Like, that's crazy to think about.
Yeah, so everyone's. I guess what I was going to ask about that, are you as the player reading the pitcher's body position or the actual ball? Like, are you watching his arm or his chest? Like, is it the big? Okay, all of it. Yeah, yeah. You're just trying to see.
Even before he throws the ball, you got to anticipate what's going to happen because you already know.
But why do you think it's going to be a fastball is what I'm saying. Like, what are you reading?
Okay. I don't think you don't think anything. Yeah, it's just intuition, right? Okay. There's literally no time for thinking.
Right. Sure. There's some context. Like there was in the World Series last year, there's some extra context that does help you kind of cheat where the Phillies were playing the Astros and their closer or starting pitcher was really good. McCullers, he was in my class, but he threw 100 miles an hour and I threw 87. Yeah. So that's why I'm here and he's over there. He would, before like a fastball, he would drop his glove below his belly button. And if he was throwing like a changeup or an off speed, he kept his glove high. And Bryce Harper picked up on that. And so that's why 7 home runs were hit that day. Not because they were like, oh, I'm better at hitting this 100 mile or reacting to this 100 miles an hour, but now I can anticipate a little better. And yeah, because some of the best pitchers, you know, back to I'm throwing out pitcher names here, Roy Halladay was really good because his arm angle, so the little tiny box where the hand was coming is where hitters are usually taught to look for. So a fastball is maybe a little higher, a curveball changes the hand position. So you're not looking at the ball. You're looking like, oh, I can see the hand is exactly. Roughly that's at 2 o'clock. Yeah. And brain goes, maybe fastball. But okay. His arm slot was perfect every time. So you had no idea what was coming. Hmm. And so on the defensive side, the less context you can give the hitter to reduce your anticipation, the better you are as a pitcher.
Sure.
But if you give away anything, then anticipation. But yeah, you're not reading really anything. Someone tried to tell me like, oh, if the ball kind of looks red coming at you, it's a curveball. If it kind of looks white, I'm like, what? I don't have time for that.
I wonder how much of an analogy there is to route setting there, because I know that like at the highest level in climbing, the climbers can look at the route setters that are going to set that event and they have like a rough idea of what types of moves to expect. And like in, you know, that's not technically on-site climbing, it's basically on-site climbing, right? And in full-blown on-site climbing, you really are making split-second decisions, especially on steep terrain. You don't have time to like actually evaluate what your body needs to do. You just have to sort of, you know, you get this like snapshot of the environment that you're in and the constraints that you're presented with, and you have to find something in your ability to adapt to those constraints, right? So information like who it is that set this route is probably super valuable, the same as like knowing the pitcher and knowing like what, you know, how their fastball looks when it's coming out. Basically, I'm sure they study it, I'm sure that you know, the good hitters are studying the pitchers.
Yeah, it doesn't happen quite as much anymore, but I mean, well, I still know some setters who do, but they'll travel with certain holds because they just know how those holds work the best and they can set them faster, but it does give them consistent patterns. And so sometimes you can see like, oh, hey, this setter is setting this event and they've been using these holds for a while, so likely we're going to get this coordination change or like something like that. So I mean, a lot of my comp athletes, like they would just nerd out all day, like in school, where they would just be on hold websites, studying every hold and constantly shifting them around so they could learn every hold. So when they saw it, they were like, oh, top left here, like, and constant shapes. Like that was one of the things that the coaches would always say is you better memorize that hold because it's coming up so often this season that you need to know that the left side is a sloper and the right side's a jug and that it does have this. And they pick up on it super fast. And that's so then amazing. The setters try to modify and hide it and like jib it out to like make them think that it's good. And then that they're like, oh, we slapped dual techs there.
So, just make it like totally unique. Local
comps, the beta is to watch the setters climb, right?
Most of the time you can't. Yeah. But
no, like just in their normal life. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure.
When they're climbing and watch them climb and be like, what kind of moves do they like? Are they really powerful? Are they like technical? Are they good at crossovers? Do they suck at hill hooking? Like, I'm sure they're all good at all those things, but like, that probably would be pretty insightful.
I mean, a really good setter, they don't even need to do the moves to set the, you know, like I don't think Jackie Godoff is still setting IFSC comps at like whatever 60 something. Yeah. He might even be 70. I don't know.
No, yeah. So he was my roommate for 18 days earlier this summer. and I got to like set under him and work with him. And yeah, I mean, he's so insightful and so fast, you know, but it's just like his modifications, like he just knows what he's going to do without ever really getting on the boulders. Like he just sees, he'll set a skeleton, pick up a couple jibs in his hand, and he'll just modify quickly based on, you know, what the forerunners are doing a little bit. And then what he needs, the what I would say that was really cool about like all of those level fives and Jackie and IFSC is that they truly are setting for their athletes. They know who's coming through the round and they know their height and their skill sets. And so it gets to the point at the higher end, the competition, that they know the athletes' strengths and weaknesses just as much as the coaches. And so they're going to be throwing things at them constantly. And like, even one of the simplest tricks I picked up was you have majority right-handed climbers, so put a lot of left-handed dominant moves, and that alone separates a field massively and stuff. So it is cool to watch how like subtle things can be. Setting is like, talk about the best way to gain skills quickly, and strategy and tactics. Like, I feel like every climber should do that more, like even just on the boards, just set as much as you can, because that's going to develop you faster than probably anything you can do. But
yeah, I think if you can't travel a lot, climbing in the gym is a good way to develop more adaptability, just because there's going to be way more varied terrain, way more varied hold for varied setters. And I even encourage people who live in areas where they can't go outside to like change up the gym they climb in. It's worth paying for a day pass or getting a punch pass to other gyms, because that variety of terrain and setting is like, it's huge. I think it's hard to not notice in the early years of climbing that when you're just letting somebody set for you, you're not really developing skills intentionally. You're just sort of developing whatever comes your way. You know, it would be like somebody made you all your meals and you had no idea if they were nutritious or not. You just like ate everything that was like put in front of you, basically, you know, and that's fine. But if you want to like maximize your potential, you sort of want to pay attention to your diet a little bit more than that.
Yeah. Also, just the stress of switching over to another gym is an important factor, is that you get so good at your home wall and where the angles are in the hold set that just moving into a different crag, you have to relearn everything and your tactics get challenged again. So definitely fun.
Hey, how often would either of you suggest people use like different terrain styles, like just locally? You know, we were just talking before we got on about a different style that I went and climbed at locally that was much more my style, which is not like the local crag. Like, Jesse, how often do you have people, like, you know, obviously if they're trying to broaden their skills outside, like have them do like some slab climbing every day as part of their kind of warm-up routine if they have long sessions? Or like, what's your typical like skills routine if someone's mostly climbing outside?
It really depends on the climber. I mean, I try to build everything from their goals, right? So if they come to me with a specific goal, I'm going to try to orient their training around moving them towards that. A lot of people, their goal is like just to get better or to progress. And in those cases, it makes more sense to bring in those sessions that are about like adaptability rather than specificity. A lot of the time, if there's something the climber obviously doesn't like, you know, if you listen to people, they'll tell you what they need, right? So if they're like telling me they hate mantles or they hate slabs or something, I'll usually give them what I call a spinach session, which is like, make sure you do a little bit of those things, you know, every week, basically. And in a lot of cases, they just need that accountability of a coach telling them to work on those skills, and they'll like get a lot of development. And in some cases, you have to like, you know, work with them back and forth with video and actually like explain how the techniques work. But that can be like a really good way of doing that too. But if I have a client who's like, I'm gung-ho on doing a V10, or I'm gung-ho on doing like this specific V10, then I would only have them do those kind of skills if there was an obvious skill gap for them with that exact problem that they wanted to do. So if their V10 had a mantle on it and they were like, the hardest mantle I've ever done is like V3, then I would be like, okay, well, you need to like build your pyramid of mantles specifically up in addition to training these other facets of that climb, you know, and getting stronger in whatever way you need to for the main part of the climb. So
cool. Yeah, I would agree with that completely. Yeah.
Very cool. On that a little bit, there's a lot of ways we can go here. On that a little bit, can you talk a little bit more about what maybe like the start to, you have talked about the meat of what you do coaching wise, but what does it look like to start? Do you have like a self-assessment process? Do you have an intake form? What information are you trying to gather from the climber if someone wants to come work with you? And then just a little bit more of a maybe clarity about what it looks like to work with you.
Sure. I probably have the most complicated and long intake form of anyone on the internet. Actually, part of how I got into coaching was I worked with a bunch of coaches like around the start of the pandemic and before the pandemic, for myself trying to level up. And I did a lot of surveys and they were all really, really physically focused. Like, how many pull-ups can you do? What's your max hand? You know, it was like 2 days of these like intense physical tests. And in some of these cases, like my partner at the time, now fiance, like did these things with me. And I remember thinking like, with the level that she's climbing at, like, I don't really know if it makes sense for her to do like a whole test and then rest for 48 hours and then do a whole nother test. Like, that's a week of climbing basically. That's just like missed out, you know, just to find out, you know, these numbers that you could pretty much guess at anyways, and it's not going to make a big difference to the training plan. So to me, I was like, what are the things that actually do matter for performance? Like I was saying earlier, I'm really interested in like the key sort of key metrics of performance. And I really don't think they're your max hang or your weighted pull up. Spoiler alert. So my survey dives more into like, I have this performance pyramid that I've talked about on some other podcasts. Maybe you've seen it on my Instagram. It's worth looking at if you're listening. But it basically lays out what I see as all the foundational elements that happen before a peak for performance. So you have like the logistical component, the lifestyle component, the social component, the emotional component, you know, your tactics. And what my survey does is it goes into detail about all those things so that usually by the time I start the initial consult with somebody, I can just say like, what did you learn from taking the survey? And they almost always got something out of it, like before we've even talked to each other. Yeah. So I got into coaching by writing that survey and having a bunch of strangers on the internet take it and like sort of refined it through that process. And I've been building on it since then. So it's pretty comprehensive. And based on that, then I kind of come up with a list of questions and I talk to people usually for an hour. And then I'm usually ready to sort of give them some recommendations. The fewer, the better.
Gotcha. Experience. Is this the pyramid? I have it up on social media already, where the base is like identity, and then it goes into logistics and life circumstances. That one?
Yep.
That's cool. So for the listeners, the Jesse's pyramid, the foundation is identity or who you are as a climber. Upon that, logistics and life circumstances. Upon that, emotional control, and then beta selection, session tactics, strength, and then finally peak effort. So that's really cool. And that's very thorough too. And I think I do remember listening to you talk on the Nugget a little bit that, and the identity, I think, is a really big one because it's like who are you as a climber and what are you going to identify as, and how does that make your path and direction and where does that lead you? So I really like the thoroughness of this pyramid.
Oh, thanks. It's so much easier to make big life changes or to like make hard decisions if you identify, you know, in your heart as a rock climber. You'll figure out ways around other obstacles in your life. You know, that might not be a comfortable truth, I think, but, and in some cases it can be a little bit privileged, but it's absolutely true still.
Yeah, I think that helps with that because my girlfriend's a runner, and someone else brought this, our nutrition coach brought up identity too, and this really works well because like climbers climb, right? So you're meant to go out there, you're meant to climb, and you might have to make those sacrifices. Runners run. Like if you want to get better at running, like, yeah, do this. But also at the same time, coaches coach. So if we in the world here is like balancing, I think is the best lesson I've learned recently. When I want to get better at climbing, I want to do this, I want to strengthen my fingers and work on this, but I'm also a coach and I have an obligation and a passion there. Like I want to be the best coach that I can be too. So I'm trying to get as much hours coaching in. I'm trying to learn as much from Tyler. I'm trying to learn as much from you guys, so on and so forth. So my identity then becomes two or threefold. And I think where I ran into issues and some other coaches have helped me clear through is trying to find balance, which may be defined as like a 50-50 all the time, every day, which I think is unrealistic, but balancing, which is a more dynamic sliding theory where sometimes I go into a coaching career high and then it may go down once I finish writing this thing. And then now I can go up into climbing a little bit and it's up and down. I think that's a little bit more realistic and practical to life, is to ride the balancing roller coaster rather than to force balance into your life all the time.
Totally. Yeah. When I was in Waco Tanks for like quite a while this winter. And I think all my coaching clients could tell you that I was like a little bit slower to respond, right? Cause I was a little bit more of a climber and a little bit less of a coach for that chunk of time. Were you going to say something, Gabe?
That actually hits really well with like the coaches going to be a coach. Like our coaches are going to coach is when I was working with Alex or like my elite athletes and everyone, like between like World Cups and Nationals and all that stuff, I was coaching so much that I like, it's far and like far away the worst I've ever climbed is during that time. Is like those 2 years, I had to give so much to the athletes that I could not perform for myself as a climber at all. And so it was kind of weird coaching the highest end athletes I've ever worked with, climbing the worst I've ever climbed. And then I got so kind of hard on myself when I tried to step up my grade because I was interacting with these elite athletes that I felt like, how can I coach them at that level when I can't do some of these basic moves that I used to be able to walk on? And then when COVID actually hit, that was the first time I actually got to take a break again. So instead of diving in, I like completely stopped climbing for a year, like first time in my career, pretty much, unless I wanted to go in for like a quick session or something. But pretty much I just quit for a little mental break, got into some other skills again. And then like, once my sight came back that like, whoa, I really need this. Then I got back in and was like grabbing skills so much faster again. And my psych was high. I was happy to coach again, happy to be an athlete. So I got to like have my identity on both sides as the climber and the coach again for the first time, instead of just being coach heavy or just climber heavy. So now it is like finding that balance, like what role one pays me, one is a passion, you know, and like one like is me. And so it's kind of like you have to do like, it is, you know, the life work balance. So it was definitely fun to learn from. And I'm getting better at it. So yeah.
Yeah, you gotta be motivated for the right reasons. Otherwise, it's gonna be really hard to get good. It's gonna feel like a slog. Totally. And one other note I had that I wrote there when you were talking, Colin, about identity is a question I learned really early on to add to my survey. And this is totally naive because, you know, I don't have kids and I'm not married yet. But I realized like I needed to ask people what their like family life situation was, because that is like, it's, if identity even has its own like striations, that's like the bottom one, right? And I realized really early on, if somebody is a father or a husband or both, like it's like, or you know, a mother obviously, or a wife, you know, obviously that is like a super important part of their identity that probably exists below their identity as a climber. And now I coach a whole bunch of people that are fathers and mothers, and I've realized that not only does it not hold them back, but in a lot of cases it can be a huge motivator. Like I have one client who he wrote on his intake form, like my main goal is to like have continuous progression, but have longevity so that, you know, my son is like 2 or 3 years old and I want to be like climbing with him when he's a teenager or in his 20s. And I was like, that right there is a motivation that will carry you for like a really long time in a sport that you can do for your whole life. So, I'm really glad I learned that lesson and added that, because it's just such an important piece of your identity.
100% from a nutritional certification that I had called Precision Nutrition, which actually was really, really good as far as certifications go. Unadvertised stamp there, because I came from a nutrition background out of college. It was pretty good. But long story short, is one of the lessons there when it came to how to effectively interview people was to ask the five whys, and essentially like, what motivates you? Blah, blah, blah. Why? And then you get into those final striations. You're like, oh, because like I want to be able to play with my kids for, and like, that's way more motivating than I want to lose 5 pounds, you know, because that doesn't really have a lot of value. Because a lot of people go and they hit these arbitrary goals and they don't get happier, and they try and understand why. But then you dive down to the deepest part of it, you know, ultimately this bottom of the pyramid and the foundation, which is the identity or those really actually motivating reasons. And then that as a coach is what you want to hone in on and get your client and the person you work with to hone on to, is like, this is the real reason we're doing this. And this will stick with you much longer than anything else that might be a little bit more superficial or upwards on the pyramid.
100%. I mean, a constant trend I notice in people that I work with is the more specific their goals are, the happier they are in general as climbers, whether they achieve them or not. And like, it's very hard to set a specific goal. I think the issue is just that, you know, asking that question of why and drilling down, if somebody's goal is like, I want to climb V7 or whatever, it's not that they just want to climb V7. It's something about their identity. They want to be the kind of person that can achieve that, or they are the kind of person who wants to feel challenged, you know, in which case, like, it's not that they want to climb V7. It's that they want to be challenged. And when they climb V7, they're going to be like, cool, I guess I want to climb V8 now. You know what I mean? It's like, it's fulfilling, but it's not as deeply fulfilling as being like, what is the sickest V7 within a couple hundred miles of where I live or somewhere I can go on a trip with the vacation that I have? And how do I prepare to do that thing and show up and smash it and be like, whoa, that was really fun. How can I do that again? Like that is a different level of getting something out of the sport. And it's not something you can just like flip a switch to. But when people do get there, I think it makes them progress faster as athletes. It makes them have more fun. They're easier to coach, frankly. So yeah. I think that's huge.
I tend to see people, since we're talking about like the parenting side, since I'm a parent as well, but I tend to see individuals in that phase of their life tend to be easier to coach as well because they're more focused. They have less time to just like get fatigued at the gym, you know? And so that was my experience for sure, is like my, you know, lack of extra time makes every session more intentional and have goals. And like, I think that in a lot of ways, you know, so a lot of people that are listening, you know, people will be stressed talking to me. I had a young kid in here who is a senior in high school. He just graduated and he already climbs V12 and he's so stressed that his finger's injured. And he's like, I'm so stressed. I'm, you know, like I got these goals to climb. I'm like, you are so young. Like I didn't climb a double digit boulder until I was 40 years old. Like you have so many years to do that. Right. But it's really hard to kind of tame and put some precision on the athletes that have a lot of free time too. So I think in a lot of ways for people that are listening, that should be, you know, having restraints is not always a bad thing.
Yeah, that's funny that you said that about the youth athlete. I was talking to an older youth athlete of mine who's now in college and was like trying to progress. And they're like, yeah, you know, I spend 20 hours a week on the tension board and then I climb outside on this. And I was like, whoa, wait. You spend 20 hours a week just on the tension board plus your other gym time or outside time? Like, are you even in school? Like, how do you do anything? Like, that's a lot of rock climbing time. And then he's,
I don't think, you know, I could spend 20 hours a month on the tension board.
Holy moly. Yeah, I mean, that's like insane amount of time. Like,
great. I could. I like the tension board.
the tension board too right now. So good. I have it. It's the best thing. It's so good.
Yeah, I love that.
I haven't touched it yet, but I do have some TB2 holds now on my hybrid grasshopper. So
yeah, it's,
I want holds from every single board ever onto that board.
Yeah. So you guys know you all know my holds on my wall. Like we mentioned before, I'm having someone come have a couple like offers in for my office because I'm selling my space. And so the plan as of now is to go work with Boone at Grasshopper and like use one of their rooms and like move all my stuff over there to like set up some testing stations for like USA climbers and people that come through that just want to like do testing and like set them up so they can just kind of use them. And then also take my holds and put them on an adjustable spray wall. So those ground holds on an adjustable wall would be so dope.
Nasty.
Yeah. I think I have like 50 of them. Like it'd be the coolest spray wall.
For sure. That's sick. V20. Crazy. Way harder.
At least they have potential to be hard, some hard problems for sure.
That's sick. That's a good idea. I mean, that's an awesome move though.
Right. In space. Yeah.
Can I jump back to something that I thought when we were talking about the tension board thing? It's actually, I've noticed this like three times in this conversation already, but something really interesting in athlete progression and definitely in coaching is how much to ask the athlete to do things that they like might not want to do. So for me, like max hangs were a good example of that. I just really didn't want to do max hangs. And so I like found a way to convince myself that they weren't important. And then later it turned out that maybe I was right that they weren't important. but like your athlete, you know, spending 20 hours a week on the tension board instead of presumably doing other things that he might not want to do as much that would probably be better for his athletic development, right?
For sure.
Or like Tyler, you were asking about like having people get on slabs or do mantles, things like that, right? Like, how much time is it appropriate to tell people to do things that they don't necessarily want to do, but might be good for them, versus sort of like trying to gently guide them on the things that they do want to do, you know? And especially applies to like that kind of like try hard, I would think, like college or just post college age, you know, where they're like really, really pushing it on the grades. And like, almost no matter what you tell them to do for a session, it's going to be like a project session and it's probably going to be on a board, you know? It's like that kind of athlete. Yeah. So where do you, I'm curious to hear you guys tell me, like, where do you think the right amount of asking people to do things they don't want to do is?
I guess my initial grab at that is I tend to give people to like go work on the skill set until they have like mind fog come in. Like when they like can't have the focus and they like aren't incentivized to be there anymore and it becomes a chore for them, then they're not gaining the skills and they should just tap out. So that might be 20 minutes for some, and that might be an hour for another person. But the second they start to mind fog, like get out, go do something that's fun for you or go home, you know,
it's
like
you got auto-regulated.
Yeah. And that, cool. Cause that could also be day to day for them because they didn't sleep well and stress or anything like that going. And if that, or it's scary for them in that day. And so they're going to just not have the threshold for that. So once mind fog kind of sets in.
Yeah, I think it has to be like that to some degree because they have to be able to auto-regulate it because the non-compliance will guide the adaptation anyway. So just not doing it certainly is a way to not get it to be useful as well, you know. And again, that's like in terms of like the rehab world, it's kind of flipped where in the rehabilitation world, if we were like trying to load a tendon that sore has like a small tendon tear, it probably doesn't matter how it's loaded as long as it's loaded, but then the athlete's preference is like really important. So it's kind of interesting how that will play a factor because then their compliance will be higher, but they'll actually put more effort and more value into the outcome of that session too. So another thing that might apply to climbing too is like if, you know, someone's working on something that they don't see any value in, that's more like an education thing almost where they need to maybe learn and understand why that's important before we just like suggest that they do it, because they're not going to put that much value in progressing or getting some sort of outcome. So it's just going to kind of be used, a waste of their time anyway. So maybe that's a good time to put them on, you know, anti-style boulders, like on a board that they aren't good at. Like it's really easy for me to get on moonboard problems that require a hand foot match and I fall to pieces, you know? And so Seeing that automatically, like, wow, I fucking really can't do that. Like, so that's something that I probably should work on a little bit, you know? So I think there's a ton of different ways you can swing it.
I mean, something interesting that's buried in there is that if you can get people to load their skill in a climbing context instead of a non-climbing context, so skill or rehab, right? Like an example that comes up constantly for me is flexibility. I get a lot of clients. I think I am perceived as being pretty flexible on social media, which I think is a fair judgment. So I get a lot of clients who they see me doing that and they're like, oh, I want to be like super flexible, but they don't want to stretch a lot. Right. And you don't have to stretch a lot, I think, to make flexibility gains if you do the right thing. But something that I've given to a lot of people that's been valuable is like learning how to employ flexibility on the wall, because it's just as much about skill. It's like probably more about skill as it is about some physical thing. Right. And what I have is a lot of skill in applying my flexibility to the wall. And I've found that a lot of people who sort of self-identify as being not flexible, once you get them to start doing some of those drills on the wall, even in an easy context, they start noticing that they can use those skills on the harder thing. And then they stop perceiving themselves as being inflexible. And it's like this feedback loop. And then maybe they're like, oh, it's kind of working. Like maybe now I'm willing to do like one end range, like training session off the wall a week or something. You can like use climbing, their mm-hmm. addiction to climbing as a way to like introduce sure. some new idea or get them to like start their rehab on the wall. And they'll be like, oh, okay, I can like kind of load this injury on the wall. Like maybe now I'm willing to like actually commit to doing my physical therapy to like rehab this injury. Right. You can just like sort of use their climbing addiction to like introduce whatever the 100%. Idea is.
That makes total sense though. Cause it can easily be said that you could do all sorts of static stretching off the wall and it won't mean anything on the climbing wall. It really won't. It's a totally different coordination adaptation. So it makes, yeah, it makes sense to be able to challenge someone on a climbing wall in a climbing context. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think that's the art of coaching, right? That kind of speaks to how good or the level of a coach that you are, in a sense where, yes, is there a off the wall optimal way to get the flexibility done? Sure. But if they're not going to do it, does it work? No. So we can leverage the fact that climbing is way fun, get them to do something and then flip it on there. It's like the finger training too. I was talking to someone who did a bunch of finger training before and then went out climbing. Is it one of Tyler's clients? And was like, oh, I don't know why I'm not actually climbing better. It's because he never really found the bridge between that and now the on-wall strength training that we've been doing a lot. And it's like, oh, I'm feeling so much more like stronger, but more intact and everything on the wall. And it's translating to better climbing. And so you don't necessarily, and that person now will love doing the off-wall stuff, but you have to show them where the rubber's going to hit the road when it comes to like the on wall climbing stuff and where it actually matters too. But yeah, just to like say, hey, it's optimal to go do a leg press to get stronger legs. Well, like screw that. I want to do uphill stuff. So you have to find that balance, but that stems back to being a really good coach and being able to identify that situation, that person. And then how do I leverage to get this wants versus needs balanced out well?
It's funny. I've told people this multiple times that like hangboarding for me is really hard because the sensation of like my feet being off the ground, it's like my anti, and like, cause I feel like I have bad beta. And so I'm like freaking out and I'm trying to compensate to do it. But if I just even put like a toe on the ground and just have anything to stop, suddenly my brain can relax again and I can hangboard fine. And it reminds me of like spotting my like youth kids is like, I'll get them to like power spot them through a move and get it used to. And I'll just have to put my finger like on their shoulder just so they feel pressure. They think that I'm spotting them through the move. And all I had to do was give them a sensation that I was helping them, even though I did nothing, but that just little bit of extra comfort allowed them to focus on the task and like get it done. So I think it's like, for me, just putting a toe on the ground can be enough that I can actually do my session. But if I lift both up, suddenly my brain's like, hey, you got bad beta, man. Like get off this hangboard, go on the wall, you know, or like go somewhere else, like put your feet back down. And so it is funny how like your brain will often override the training with just the comfort level. You know, you have to think, you have to find the skill there.
I'm like fully convinced at this point that someone could become one of the strongest climbers in the world without ever picking their feet up off the ground on a hangboard.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I never lift my feet up, you know, for the most part, because it's just
too hard. Funny is most youth climbers do that. Like I have quite a few youth climbers that will come in here and test, and their strength weight ratios when you actually measure their forces are huge, but they've never used a fingerboard.
Yeah. Totally.
So it's like, there's no doubt that really the ability to be coordinated on a climbing wall trumps everything off the wall. And so, you know, we want to like use anything off the wall only for a very intentional reason. And then we have to apply that to the climbing wall, like, you know, with more of the actual sport itself, which has been like a really confusing thing over the last 10 years in climbing for some reason.
I give the example of someone today, like if you have someone with 100 pounds of finger strength, but they can only really utilize 50% of it. And then you take someone with 70 pounds of finger strength, but they can use 100% of it. Like who's the stronger climber? Does it come down to the objective numbers? Like, no, it comes down to who can apply it well. And that's where that building the bridge of numbers to actually on-wall application comes in and really builds the progress.
That's exactly what that pyramid is trying to get at, is like for each layer of the pyramid leading up to that, like performance, you know, it's like, okay, you can generate this much force, but you like read the route wrong and you didn't do a drop knee where you were supposed to, right? Or okay, you can generate this much force, but you were late to the parking lot and your friends left without you, or like you forgot to bring enough food and you were hungry and you couldn't have enough tries at the thing. There's so many things that can go wrong before you ever get a chance to like use your finger strength, that to like just chase finger strength as an example in this case, as being like the one metric, is just, it seems really kind of misguided to me. It's just people like easy answers, right? It's nice to imagine that like, if I just make this number go up, if I chip away at this number, then my V grade or my five, you know, my Yosemite decimal grade will like go up in accordance with it. And I think it just doesn't work that way.
It's amazing to how many people it just doesn't. No, I've never met anyone that it does. And, but still gets talked about that it does, which is
cool. And on the flip side, like I stopped doing formal training like that, you know, maybe 3 years ago or something, like doing max hang style training. I still do like auto-regulated finger training and still add some weight, pick stuff off the ground, but not nearly as organized as I did for probably 5 or 6 years. And my finger strength keeps going up. I mean, I boulder most of the year. Like, of course my finger strength is going to keep going up. So it's,
Yep. And probably to circle back a little bit to what we do for this, I think one of my aha moments and things I'm noticing with people I work with is I always prescribe an underwhelming amount of stuff. Like the first reaction is like, wait, this is it? This is all we're going to do? And my goal, kind of like what Tyler said too, is first I have to be really good at educating them on why. And I think even further back too is as a coach, a big quote that always sticks to me is no one knows they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So it's first like the coach client interaction. Then you actually have to know what you're talking about, because then you have the ability to say, this is why I'm only giving you like 2 days worth of stuff, because I know your ass is going to be in the gym for 6 hours trying to do more stuff. Right. And so I always kind of shoot for the minimum effective dose. And that's always been my life. And like Tyler said,
I think when I realized that was when I got so busy as a coach and I didn't have enough time to do a lot. And I was still just as strong as I was in college with way more time. I was prehabbing and rehabbing and lifting and practicing and this and that. I was the most hurt I was in my athletic physical career, but I was still kind of strong. And then fast forward to coaching when I had 2 days a week, and I was, you know, objectively and randomly a trap bar deadlift at like 500 pounds or whatever that I never could have done in college. And I was like, oh, maybe I don't need 7 days a week to do this. And then the wheel started turning and, you know, fast forward to today and my underwhelming programs that you will see if I write them for you. But, and then there's like, okay, well, we can do a little bit of fun here. Oh, you want to do bicep curl? Sure. But make sure you keep this in principle in mind. And so I think it's all about, yeah, the art of coaching and knowing how to do, how to read the person and how to really build that connection, but then show them the value in what you're doing. Maybe with a little bit of education, but also being a good person and a good person to work with on a team. So
at the top of the podcast, Colin, you asked me how I work with people and I didn't really answer that question, but one of the main ways I work with people after they've taken the assessment is I'll write them what I call a training brief. And the training brief is basically like, I tell them, you know, here are what I think are the 3, 4, 5 things that are probably holding you back the most in your climbing. And it's not like a plan of what to do or like a weekly schedule. Sometimes I'll make an exercise suggestion, but I usually let them figure out like the load, you know, or I'll give them like a rep, like a set rep scheme suggestion. Right. But I won't like write it out for them entirely. Most of the time, it's more like, you're not making eye contact with your footholds and you need to make eye contact with your footholds until you're done putting your foot on them. And you should work on that and come back to me in 8 weeks. You'll be a better climber than you were now. You don't need this like huge ornate plan, right? And I do write huge ornate plans for some athletes too, because either that's what they want or that's what they need or both. But like in a lot of cases, all you need is a couple suggestions and then you can go work on that. And you can come back to the coach like a couple months later. And that's plenty to make progress from where you're at. So I really love that style of coaching. I think it's becoming more popular. At least the two of us are doing it. I think a lot more people are doing it too now.
Yeah. I'm smiling at what you're saying right there, because I'm sure that like you see it too with all your clients too. When you look at video footage or intake or anything like that, like there's like pretty much 3 habits that like a climber is going to have that you're like, I could say this for you almost every time. And it's look at your foot, watch it place. Stop taking away your momentum, you know, like use momentum. Yeah. Like
that's definitely like, one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, those don't just kill me where you're just like these really simple ones, but then they're like, okay, I've done that. What's the next one? And you're like, no, you didn't do that. That was 2 days ago. I just told you that 2 days ago. Like you need to just play, like keep going, like keep playing with it. Now, like try another terrain, see what it's like at this level and this level.
And it's a lifelong endeavor, honestly. Totally. Like, absolutely. I can think of multiple examples where I was trying something really hard and I watched video of myself and I was like, oh my God, I'm like locking my arm off on that move when I need to like rotate my shoulder in, you know? And it's like some really hard problem that I've been trying for days and days and days. And then I realize I'm doing something fundamental wrong when I watch my video. And then I do that thing right. And I like send the problem. And I'm like, wow, I was overlooking one of the first pages in how to be a good rock climber training book, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes me smile. Like I did a session yesterday that I was filming myself and I kept thinking, I feel what I'm doing wrong and I'm so close. And then after like 3 falls of feeling what I was doing wrong and still not hitting it, I was like, I gotta video it and then video it. And it's completely, oh, this is what's wrong. Not this sensation that I thought I knew. Once I saw it on the video, it was like, oh, this foot's dropping, correct that. And then I just tightened it up, put the little tension there and hit it first try. And it was like, you may think you feel what the error is, but you should see it as well. And like,
well, they're different.
You can really know. Inputs. Yeah, they're totally. And so it's like, use more senses. Likely you're going to have better successes, you know? And so like include as much as you can, but it's kind of funny to self-coach. Like my favorite thing about videoing myself is I can just swap the hat. So super fast of being like, I'm the coach who thinks I know what I'm doing, but then the second I see myself in a video, I'm like, oh, this athlete is messing up here. And like, I don't even see myself. I see like this athlete who's just like messing up and like, oh no, yeah, you didn't do this. And then I can go over the wall with like the cues from my coach and then get it done and just swap the hats. So easy that way. But if I stay in one version, whether it's the athlete or the coach on the wall who's upset that they can't figure out the move, or the athlete who's getting in their head without just taking the cue from a coach, it can just totally bring my session down. And so kind of just doing that hat swap is super important for me.
That's smart. And I mean, it keeps you from seeing it in like a very qualitative kind of way too. Like, you're not judging your performance as a climber necessarily. You're not looking at it and being like, oh, I'm dog shit. You're looking at it and you're putting your coach hat on and sort of thinking the problem through the same way you would for a client. Cause I don't know about you, but when I look at myself as a climber, I'm a lot harder on myself. You know, I'll walk up to like
way harder
a grade that I've flashed like 100 times, and I'll be with one of my friends and I'll be like, ooh, I don't know. Like, this doesn't really, I'm not sure if I can do this. And my friend will just be like rolling their eyes. But of course you can flash this. Right. And if I like step back and like, you know, I'm more objective about it, I can be really, really clear. But in that moment, I think every climber, it's like, it's hard not to be hard on yourself when you watch video of yourself, or when you're like stepping up to the plate to try, there's another baseball metaphor, to try something difficult for you.
Man, yeah.
Probably the only baseball metaphor I know.
I'm striking out on these puns that you guys are. Hey, yo.
That's right. Now that you work with Tyler and I, who come from the college baseball background, you guys have to. Like, we're not really climbers. We're baseball people with a finger problem. So that's why we're here. It's awesome here.
I wanted to say one other thing on the video thing is I think a lot of people I work with fall into these like archetypes, you know, and one of the archetypes I see is people who don't like looking at video of themselves. And so that's something I've like worked with people a bunch of times, but fundamentally, I think that stems from like a lack of familiarity with your own climbing style, not necessarily like disliking it, but you just don't see it much. And you sort of develop this, like this fear of what it looks like, or this dislike of what it looks like. And that, you know, is something that it's very helpful to be able to break through, because that familiarity and comfort is like exactly what you want to develop in order to understand your technique and change it. But also, like, it will, you know, this sounds kind of new agey, but like, it will help you learn to like love yourself in the way that you climb and the way that you move. And that's so important for like developing well as an athlete. Like,
same point, we're agreeing. I think it's often people who have the hard time watching videos also have hard times looking themselves in the mirror, you know, like sometimes just like even lifting in front of the mirror or full body mirror, like we're so critical of how we're looking, like just ourselves or our appearance all the time, that like sometimes that's just a part of it, is like confidence of from, you know, the bedroom of putting on how you're dressing to go to the gym to you on the gym filming yourself. Like, you have to have like a bit of confidence and be comfortable just like seeing what you're working with currently, and you can always then progress it to something else in the future. But like, your current body is your current baseline. Like, you can change it, but like, it's not happening in a session, it happens over more. And so like, be comfortable getting used to, you know, it, and then just seeing the improvements as you're going towards that goal. But I think sometimes it can just be image confidence stemming right from getting out of the bed to actually in the gym.
For sure. Yeah, I've talked about this before, but like, I relentlessly take video and I post like uncut footage to a YouTube and stuff, and I notice on all my hardest sends, there's always like a foot cut or like a little sequence bobble, or like my gaze goes to the wrong hold at the wrong time, or like, you know, I lose body tension and like yell in a place I shouldn't. There's always like something that's like not, you know, even the ones that are like really good, I can always find something to pick apart. And that like really bothered me for a long time. I was like, why can't I like send something perfectly, you know? I was like so frustrated. But like, when other people watch those videos, they do not see that stuff. They don't think about it the same way that I do. And I started to learn to realize that like, actually that one tiny thing that I'm obsessing over is really just, that's my personality and not a problem with the way that I climbed the rock. And it sort of represents, you know, if that iota of quote bad technique or whatever, if that's what I'm hyper-focused on, it actually means that like 99.9% of what I did on that climb was probably pretty good.
Really well, yeah.
Right? And it just took me like 12 years or something
to come around to that. Well, and I'm sure like if we all watched like any, you know, kind of curated pro video right now, if you ask that pro, hey, like, what did you fumble in that move? They're hyper aware of that boulder. So they're going to tell you, hey, I missed this foot. Like, you think I landed that foot perfectly, but I was up high on it or whatever. And like, I had to like compensate in the shoulder more than I should have, because they just know the climb better than the viewer does. And so I think sometimes like we're hyper aware of how we're looking in that bounce because we know the sensation that we felt, but the viewer doesn't. Right. And so, yeah, I'm very hard on myself on that too, when it comes to posting it. Like people are like, why don't you ever post stuff? I'm like, it is one of the things, especially as like a technique coach, you know, like that's what I think we do. I think you get extra hard on it because you're like, well, I should be showing perfect technique at all points. And you're just like,
yeah,
you know,
but you know,
we're
what?
Not perfect, you know, like at the same
I'm
time.
I'm also like a mindset coach. So I just soak all that stuff up. I'm like, people want to see me fail and struggle and like, yeah, totally. But it was cracking me up earlier. Actually, when we were in this call, I was thinking how funny it is that like, Colin seems like a little bit more of on the strength side of things. And I know Tyler's on the strength side of things. And you guys are like both jacked and me and Gabe are both like super skinny.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We complete each other.
Yeah.
So I was just gonna say, because I'm posting videos all the time. I don't care what I look like. I'm like, oh, I just made that thing look awesome. I hang from three fingers, weighing 240 pounds. Just wait until I learn how to use a foot and start sending stuff. Actually, so
yeah. Do you actually weigh 240? Are you serious?
Close to 240. Yeah,
dude. I'm imagining what it would be like if I put a weight vest on of the difference and tried to climb anything. I couldn't climb anything.
Right. Try to be the 240 guy that sends my 512 project.
That's impressive as hell, man. Yeah, that's absolutely. So impressive.
I think it didn't happen yet. So we're getting there. But Gabe's been there. I was at my high point when Gabe was belaying me in the snowy months of Pennsylvania. But
yes.
That's been awesome. Rolling back to all of that, I think that where we went from was that underwhelming program with an overwhelming amount of value, I think is the biggest thing from there. And all the side conversations, which is really good. I love like how you guys can riff off each other and all this stuff is a huge benefit to the people we're going to work with. Does anyone have any time constraints? I know we are at almost the hour mark here. I know we can chat about this forever, but
yeah, I was going to say, it's like, I'm fine. I'm safe. Yeah.
Okay.
I probably have 20 more minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'd say let's just throw into some like any, final major points that you guys would like to wrap up on, and then we can start to taper off here.
Like little miniature hot takes or what?
Yeah, let's do a little last 10-minute hot take. Oh, what was the one about the four? Oh, okay, the 4x4 puppy picture, the 4x4s, and just people getting better at climber. Go.
All my hot takes come with a puppy picture, so that if people don't like what I have to say, they can just look at the picture of my dog puppy. And like feel heartwarmed, right. You know. No, but I think I don't know. 4x4s are right there with max hangs. I don't really ever prescribe them, and I don't think they're super valuable. I think they're actually actively harmful. Like a lot of like popular climbing training is actively harmful. Like I frequent the Climb Harder subreddit. I've been on there for like a really long time, and that place has become it's sometimes useful, it has its merits, but it's also become like incredibly toxic. And one type of post that's on there a lot is like, critique my training plan, you know. And I just know before I even click on these things now that it's going to involve like all the popular sort of sessions, you know. 4x4s are going to be in there somewhere. It's probably going to be like max hangs one day, and then like limit bouldering the next day, and then like 4x4s the third day. And I'm just thinking, like, by the fourth day of this training plan, if you're not like broken in half, then you were already so strong that you didn't need to do those things in the first place, and you probably should have been doing something else anyway.
Yep. Or you're gonna need to recover for the next week. Yeah.
Yeah. So I started writing a blog post on the 4x4 thing, and I'll probably defer most of that conversation to that blog post. Maybe we can talk about it on the podcast in a future thing. But
yeah,
I do think there are good reasons to do it, but I don't think they're the reasons that most people do it. And one good example that I will talk about is it makes you really good at like pushing through discomfort. And there is a lot of value in that in climbing. And I don't want people to think that I don't think try hard is important, because it is extremely important, especially for bouldering. So I coach some high level comp athletes. And one thing that I really like to have them do is do like a super strenuous physical thing, and then back to back it with something like really technical and intricate. So like, a limit problem that you can send. So like whatever your highest thing you can send is like on the moon board. And then you're going to like go over and try to do a coordination slab in like 2 minutes. That super, super useful. It's just not looking at it through the lens of what energy system am I training, right? Because when I give them that exercise, I just, they're probably going to get pumped, but like, that's not the point of the exercise. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to get pumped that way in a competition anyway. It's going to be a totally different thing. What I need them to be able to do is control their psychological arousal level and do mm-hmm. good climbing when their yeah. brain is like, you know, getting attacked by music and loud lights and like physical discomfort and stuff. Sorry, bright lights, not loud lights, like physical discomfort and all these things. I need them to be able to like execute on the wall in that state. And we can practice that without just getting pumped on a steep wall by doing like 60 moves. They're never going to do 60 moves in a row in a boulder competition. It just doesn't make sense for a boulderer to do that kind of thing. So I'll cut the rant off there.
No, I mean, that's right on for coaching any, especially comp athletes. Like that's right on of a waste of their time. I mean, even rope athletes, like most lead climbing comps right now are like 34 to 48 moves tops. And so, you know, there's not that many times where you're needing to push too much past that, but keeping that threshold higher. And then, you know, you can get them pumped way easier, like by just having them go from closed crimp, like ladder climbing, to suddenly open hand, and just having that pump fatigue and a hand drop instead of them having to change how their body is. Just get the forearm pump going. And like, that's my favorite thing to have people do, is climb open hand slopers for a while and then closed crimp. Suddenly they're like, oh my God, my arm is slow. And you're like, boxed. That's how the setter gets you right there, is, mm-hmm. oh, I put you on slopers all day, and now I had you bone crushing crimp something. And you're just like, oh, I didn't think my fingers worked anymore, or vice versa. Crimp, crimp, crimp. Now you hit a sloper and your brain just fatigues. And so you're like, oh my God.
That develops that mental toughness of being able to change context and keep trying hard without stopping and having to like deal with what's going on.
Yeah, and they're not going to compensate in their technique. It's like, that's just here. And so I can have you do that in a ladder and still get that sensation, but I got to keep all my training and the high end of effort on the wall where I needed you.
So kind of like first principles, like I was saying earlier about how it doesn't matter how strong your fingers are if you like miss the drop knee or you like show up late or didn't bring a snack or whatever. So same kind of idea, right? If I had an athlete who wanted to lead and that was their focus, like a 4x4 makes sense for the energy system, maybe, as long as it's like the same angle and everything, right? But it's not training the other skills that you need. So if you want to go outside, like Colin, if you want to go climb your 512, right? Like, you need to deal with the big ticket items. Like, can you climb above your bolt? Do you have the sequence dialed? Are you reading the route correctly? Like, if you don't have those things addressed, then I just don't care how long you can hang on to the wall, because you're going to need to hang on for so much longer to achieve your goal than if you dealt with those other skills in the first place.
Well, that, or even the people who do the 4x4 of doing the same boulder four times, that one's extra. It's kind of weird too, because you're like, well, if you're a comp climber doing that, that's efficiency at this point, where you're only getting more tuned to that boulder, where you're just kind of charging to rest points and blah, blah, blah. And like, you're never going to experience the same climb four lengths high. And so yeah, it's definitely not a great workout unless people really, you know, like, I guess I always say like, climbing's a game. So like, play the game how you need it, set their parameters how you need it. And so like, you know, at the end of the day, you're just the player of a game. So like, what game are you playing today? Set the game, set the stage, you know, adjust your parameters, and then there you go. That's how I would make a really efficient session, is by just setting your game, you know?
Yeah. We talked about, you know, the 4x4s before, but too, I totally agree with everything. So you fit the team well. So, but there's just, and people try to like send the 4x4 rather than use it again for what it's meant to do. Like, principally, even without a title, we're trying to maybe improve endurance or whatever. But again, endurance is like hold type, pacing, length, all this kind of, and realistically, like time to failure too, I think is ultimately what it is. Because realistically, I haven't climbed a bunch of really tall, super sustained, the same exact edge route all the time. But if you as a human are just improving on the physical side of things, just improving your time to failure, you're improving your endurance, right? Everything else is going to be a combination of everything else. And so those things have to kind of get separated.
That's kind of an interesting thing I've never just kind of heard, but we probably should use more often, is instead of time under tension, time to failure is probably a better reference of like, a lot of people aren't doing they're thinking their time under tension, but they're really time under, like, time to failure, where they start to compensate and adjust everything until they just can't get on. Versus time under tension is like, no, like, as my tension started to broke, the rep failed, I got off before technique broke. So I think like that could be a good way for us to start describing things too, is like,
for
I
sure
think even going time to failure instead.
Interesting. Yeah.
Right. Even like the hangboard, so like for like an endurance thingy, I'll have a specific parameter. So maybe it's like 12-inch box, 25mm, half crimp. We're gonna go 7-3 until failure. But your failure has a as soon as that thing breaks, done. Off.
Yeah.
Off. Like I, and over the course of the 3 or 4 weeks, I just want you to improve that parameter. Not even really thinking about, because it's super general. Like, we're not getting better at climbing, we're not climbing the overhang, but I just want to give you a little bit of physical capacity. And then we can kind of slide off. And just getting people to realize and identify the goal is like, you have improved your endurance. Now, can you take a little bit of that and not bullshit your way? Like, don't lose it by any of the things that we talked about. Like, now you're ruining the sequences and all night. All right, now I'm passing, you know, that person off to you guys to handle. It's like, I gave you the big gas tank. Now don't screw it up. Right.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I think like something that ties back to the 4x4s and really makes sense with that too is like, you can do that kind of training cycle on a hangboard or something, but then if you switch your focus to developing the skills, like those adaptations may stay, and presumably you would want to keep doing something that's like very specific and directed to maintain those adaptations. But it's kind of like another ball in the air that you have to keep juggling, versus if you develop the skills first and then you add the physical training on top of it, those skills that you develop, you have to like upkeep them, you know, and you have to keep climbing in that context. But as long as you work on that stuff a little bit, the skills really do stick around. So like for me, I've climbed on granite basically my whole career. Granite, I'm very comfortable on, even though it's like notoriously technical rock type, right? And if I like went somewhere else for a couple of years and then came back here, I would probably still feel very comfortable in that context. It's just like a skill that I've got a baseline in. Same thing goes for endurance climbing, and like really good endurance climbers can be a little bit less fit, but still succeed to like an exceptional level. You know, I know people who like, they've done like 514 and they'll like take a bunch of time off or go bouldering or get busy with work, and they can still like on-site 513 on that terrain. And it's not because they're super fit, right? They're not. They will tell you that they're not super fit. And you could tell by looking at them that they're not super fit. And actually, I would even say their time to failure, you know, to use that lingo, is still low, and maybe even lower than the time under tension. They just know how to like keep paddling.
I would say I'm pretty close to that at a local area of ours, that like the last 2 years I've just been trying to do bouldering just to like up, because of the sport projects I had, I just was hitting like the physical threshold of like not being able to do the boulders. And so I took a ton of time off, and then I came back to that area and was just walking projects that used to just wreck me as a sport climber because the physicality of it. But now I'm so efficient at resting, and I know the rock and I know how it behaves, that I'm like, I don't have the endurance, but I know how to rest still, and I can do it. And now I have the physical ability to not like waste as much energy like trying to compensate around it when I was technical and had the endurance, but not the strength. And so, yeah, it's kind of a fun little balance there.
You probably like lose a tiny bit of your top end if you're a boulderer by doing some sport climbing, and you probably lose a little bit of your top end as a sport climber by doing some bouldering. Absolutely. But the truth is, if you're taking your climbing career in the like 10, 15, 20 year view or longer, it just makes sense to do both. You get so much more adaptability as an athlete, and like being economical is so much more important in bouldering than people give it credit for. And being powerful is so much more important in sport climbing than people give it credit for. Like just doing both sports is a pretty solid training plan, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, and also like, even if you're a boulder, like you can still go sport climbing on shorter routes. I don't get why that one is. People are like, oh, well, I mean, I don't have enough endurance. You're like, that whole climb is 5 bolts. You know, like you can go find some shorter sport climbs that will feel like highball boulders, you know, or something like that, or just endurance-y boulder. So I think that could definitely be little crossovers there.
Highball boulders that were like longer than some of the short sport routes that I've
done. Exactly. Totally. Yeah. Like,
yeah, it cuts both ways. And then the cool thing is like, if you're a boulderer and you want to have better endurance, doing, you know, a little campaign of like long or of short sport routes will develop that endurance, but it will also teach you the skills of being economical on the wall, and that will transfer back to your bouldering. And ta-da, you've become a more efficient climber, and you didn't have to do any goddamn 4x4s. Like, everybody wins.
for sure. Yeah, I agree with that.
Simple, underwhelming yet overwhelming value. Simple.
Yeah. Keep it simple. Keep it simple for sure.
It's funny how it always comes back to that too. And you know, we'll still dive down the details of the molecules of Titan and passive tension, and you know, that's just us in the nature of questioning yesterday to make sure tomorrow is accurate in what we're telling our clients and whatnot. But it's always funny because at the end of the day, it always comes down to just what's the simplest, least amount of stuff we can do to get you better.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really have to be a multi-syllable word, just be climb. So so that was awesome. Let's probably wrap it up there for the sake of everyone's time. And again, I feel like we could be on here for a 4-hour podcast, which I know you've done on the Nugget, but we ain't got time for that right now. So maybe one day on the weekend. So yeah, thank you guys so much for showing up today in the midday. That was great. Jesse, obviously welcome. You're one hell of a fit for the team, and you and Gabe are going to be a unique yin and yang by themselves, and then you'll mix in with the jacked me and Tyler.
Yeah, that was awesome. Thanks for welcoming me onto the team. It's good to be here. I'm excited.
Yeah, it's been great.
Absolutely. All righty, gentlemen, you guys have a great rest of your day. Let me hit first and record before I mess this up and lose all that 90 minutes. Stop recording.